Today's episode of This Week on Broadway is supported by Heartbeat Opera. Go to heartbeatopera.org to learn more. Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio. It's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, May 14th, 2017. Happy Mother's Day. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today we have Peter Felicia, Michael Portantier, and Matt Tamanini. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Masterworks, Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Hello, Peter.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, Everything Sondheim, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You could see his photography work at filespotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Welcome back from Boston.
Oh, thanks. Thanks.
We're gonna have
it was a great trip.
We're going to talk about that in a few minutes.
Yeah.
Matt Tamanini is also with us. Matt is Broadway World's senior TV and film critic and the host of Some Like It Pop podcast, which is available at iTunes and Stitcher. You also may hear Matt and I chat for 10 or 15 minutes every morning, Monday through Friday on This Week on, actually today on Broadway, not This Week on Broadway. And you can also connect with Matt on Twitter at BWWMatt. All right. In our review section, Michael, you got a chance to see The Golden Apple over at Encores. Peter is going today, so why don't you give us your review of Golden Apple?
I reviewed the show for TalkinBroadway.com. We can put a link to that review. And I described it as a wish-come-true production, and I think that's very appropriate. This The Golden Apple, I think, is generally considered to be one of the first cult musicals. It has all of the earmarks of a cult musical. It had a very short run on Broadway in 1954. The subject matter is it's rather heady, I guess one would say. The music is phenomenal by Jerome Maross. I believe that's the correct pronunciation. And the libretto by John Latouche is brilliantly witty and fabulous in every possible respect. This show represents some of the best music and lyrics ever heard on Broadway, but it's so special. It's a modern day adaptation of Homer's The Iliad and the Odyssey, set in Washington State in the early 1900s, just after the Spanish-American War. And Maross and Latouche came up with a really clever modern equivalent. Then, well, even then it wasn't quite modern, but you know what I mean. Equivalent of the what happens in the Iliad and the Odyssey. And an interesting thing is that they kept the names of most of the major characters, including Ulysses, Penelope, Helen, Paris, Menelaus, Hector, et cetera, et cetera. So I said in my review, I think that all of this may have intimidated the audience back in 1954 when they heard what this show was. It had a very successful run off-Broadway at the Phoenix Theater, and then it just critical accolades everywhere, incredible reviews, and that prompted their move to Broadway. But there it lasted only 125 performances, because it's not quite, even then, it's not quite the kind of fare that one might expect to be a Broadway hit. It's through sung, and it's very, very clever and witty, and it's just really brilliant, but it's not for everyone. Interestingly enough, I saw some walkouts during intermission at the performance I attended at Encores. And I have heard from others that there are lots of empty seats, which makes me sad, but I guess I'm not terribly surprised. It's a very, very special piece. It's because of the through sung aspect and certain other things, it's not as involving with the characters in the way that some other shows are. And I guess that's a liability, but it just has so much else going for it that, you know, I'm so thrilled that Encores did it. It's exactly the kind of show they should be doing. The cast is great. Lindsay Mendes is Helen. Ryan Silverman as Ulysses. Penelope is a very young woman named Michaela Bennett, who I believe is still at Juilliard. And Paris, which is only a dancing role, no dialogue. Well, nobody has any dialogue through sung, as I said before, but he doesn't sing. He only dances. Danced beautifully by this young man named Barton Cowperthwaite, who I'm told was a very late replacement and learned the role in 2 days. I believe the other person that he replaced got injured. The production values of this presentation are almost equivalent to a full production. No scripts really anymore at Encores, certainly not in this production. There are some lovely drops and even some set pieces. The costumes are full costumes. And the orchestra under Rob Berman sounds absolutely beautiful. The orchestrations, as several people have noted, are also among the best ever heard on Broadway, orchestrations by Jerome Maras and Hershey Kay. So I am going back tonight. I'm buying another ticket. And cause I could not be more thrilled, and this has to be seen at least once. I'm going to see it twice.
Michael, one of the finest things I've ever seen in my life was the production at Boston University in 1974. So I'm looking forward to this tremendously, and I'm delighted to hear that you're as enthusiastic about it as you are. So I wish that it could run longer so that people hearing us talk about it here would be able to go. But we're lucky to get it at all, because this is the one that so many of us have been wanting Encores to do since day one. Does Paris fly in on a balloon?
They even do that, and they do it so simply but so effectively. It's a set piece that comes in, and he's not actually in it. We don't see him in it because it's just a set piece. It's like basically a drop that looks like a balloon, but it really looks like a balloon. And then he like sort of pops up from the carriage of the balloon. And it seems like he's been in it all along. The only previous production of this that I saw was several years ago up at Vassar. Did you see that one?
No, I remember when they did it. I heard the sound was bad.
Yeah, the sound was unfortunately bad. It was full orchestra, and the mix was awful. Unfortunately, I don't think they had mics for the singers. But that was a really really great taste of it, and now we've seen it done to pretty much to perfection. I can't stress, by the time this podcast appears, unfortunately this run will have been completed. It's really not for everybody. I have heard several people tell me that they thought it was boring. So it's just one of those things that it's for those who love it, they adore it. And then there are other people who just don't get it. But that's fine. That's great.
It wouldn't be a cult show if it weren't, that
exactly.
Way.
Oh, exactly. Thank you. Exactly.
All right. So as Michael pointed out, by the time you hear this, unfortunately, the moment will have passed. Any word or rumor if they're going to record it?
Well, I don't know. I was thinking that they would, but then I knew this and I forgot that there was a complete recording released only about 2 years ago on PS Classics of a live performance of a production in Irving, Texas, the Lyric Stage. Yeah. And actually they were selling that recording at City Center. So I bought it, and it was the first time I'd heard it, and I'm happy to say it's just beautiful. So I suspect because that one exists, they probably won't do the Encores one.
But this brings up another interesting point, because as you say, it's a live recording, but when you're listening to it, you don't know it's a live recording for a long time, because it takes a long time for that audience to applaud. It's really surprising when you hear the applause about 15 minutes into it, which again tells you it's a cult musical, because I don't think the audience is having that good a time that it takes them that long to applaud.
I agree that they don't seem to be having that great a time, but also I think in fairness, the way the show is written, there aren't a lot of places where there are applause cues. That's because true. a lot of the songs dovetail into each other.
That's true. That's
yeah.
true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Today's episode of This Week on Broadway is supported by Heartbeat Opera. If you're someone who has an ear out for innovative theater companies in New York, then you need to know about Heartbeat Opera. They're an indie opera company, and they're known for taking classic operas and presenting them in surprising, intimate adaptations. It's an opera experience unlike anything that you've seen before. They've been called pioneers by the Wall Street Journal, radical by the New Yorker, and this month they're presenting their unique take on the classic operas Butterfly and Carmen at the Baruch Performing Arts Center in Manhattan. If you've never experienced opera in an intimate setting like this, where you can see and hear up close the emotions of the singers, then you don't want to miss this. This is a limited run, just 1 week, from May 20th through the 28th, so be sure to get your tickets while they're still available. They start at just $35. Go to heartbeatopera.org to learn more and find tickets. That's heartbeatopera.org. Up, Peter jumped in his car and headed down to the Bucks County Playhouse in New Hope, Pennsylvania, and saw Clue on stage. So, Peter, tell us about this adaptation of the board game into a musical.
It's really more an adaptation of the 1985 movie than the board game.
Ah.
And if you like that movie by Jonathan Lynn, who did the screenplay, you'll probably be pleased by this production. Needless to say, it won't be as ornate. But frankly, I think the best thing about the production was the set by Ana Luisos, because, you know, as we all know, anybody who's played this game, I don't know if kids still do it. I don't know if they play games at all. There's probably a video game version of Clue. But you have to come up with a ballroom, a billiard room, a cellar, a conservatory, a dining room, a hall, kitchen, library, lounge, and study. Okay, now how do you do that on a summer stock budget? It's not easy. And I assumed I was going to see a unit set. And while there is a unit set for much of the show, which, by the way, looks amazingly, as if I remember correctly, and I may not because it's been a long time, looks amazingly like the set for Moose Murders. Anyway, the other rooms have to be there, too. And somehow she has made it happen by sliding things in and gliding things out and flying things in. And it's very, very impressive to watch this set become other rooms. So, of course, you know about reviews that when one starts with a rave for the set, the show can't be much good. And again, here's another cult show in the sense that this is a real cult movie. The movie was a terrible bomb when it came out. The budget was $15 million. They took in $3 million. However, over the years, it has become a big favorite. And I suspect the reason is when it was first done, it had three different endings. And I imagine what you had to do was go see the movie three times to see all the endings. Well, what people tend to do in things like that is either go to all three or go to none at all. And most people decide to go to none at all. And that's why the movie bombed. But once at least DVDs came in, I don't know if it was true of the videotape. I don't even know if it was ever on videotape. They put all three endings on. So, you know, once you buy the property, it's you got a ball. So it's a very convenient thing to watch all three. which they've sort of put in. They've done an amalgam of all three, sort of. And so, again, if you know the movie well, you will recognize bits and pieces of the three movies. But really, it seems to me virtually word for word to the movie. And I'm not just letting my memory rely on that, because last night on YouTube I watched the movie, and I saw it yesterday afternoon, so as a result it was really fresh in my mind, and I was amazed how close it was to the movie. Though Hunter Foster, who directed, and his collaborator Eric Price say that they've done stuff to the script. They have. I'm sure they, you know, it's not word for word, and for that matter, they've changed the occupation of Professor Plum. He's now a playwright, though you'd think they'd mine more jokes, certainly theatrical ones, from that, but they don't. Cast is excellent, especially Carson Elrod, who many of us saw recently at Classic Stage in The Liar. Terrific performance, knocks himself out. He plays Wadsworth, which is the part that Tim Curry played in the movie, the butler. So, and he is the engine that has to make this thing go, and he makes it go tremendously. At the end of the show, even though I was in row J, I could see that he was sweating profusely. And sometimes that's a bad sign, in the sense that, you know, they're nervous or something like that, but this is not the case. He works so hard, he's entitled to that sweat. So really, really good. Aaron Dilley plays the part that Madeline Kahn did, and because I hadn't seen the movie since 1985, which, by the way, had the best press party I have ever been to in my life at the Park Street Armory. They had all these rooms, I mean, tables groaning with food, but anyway. So I hadn't seen the movie since the original release, and there I was saying to myself, who does this woman remind me of? And finally I figured out it was Madeline Kahn, and I had forgotten that she was actually in the picture. So she is really, really channeling, which may be a euphemism for imitating Madeline Kahn, but she does it very, very well. So I'm not going to really complain about that. I also like Kevin Carolyn as Colonel Mustard, who was very, very grounded. Everybody's good. They really work very hard, but it's the type of direction that goes a little over the top. And while occasionally in the movie, when somebody says, like, he's dead, and everybody gasps in unison, you know, you hear all the voices go, ah, you know, that type of thing. That happens a lot more on the stage show. Also, when they have to go places, they use the same tiptoeing in unison together to the other place. And that's supposed to be funny, and to a degree it is. Audience liked the show. Packed house, and I suspect it's from all these people who love the movie. And again, it really has become a beloved after the fact movie. So I guess if you like the movie, you should make an effort to go down to Bucks County, an hour and a half away from New York anyway, and you'll probably be pleased, I guess. I mean, you may resent the fact that it's the movie is in a more ornate place. You know, the action is far more vivid, as you actually do go from room to room where they have to run around and all that kind of stuff. But I would really say that half the audience loved it and half the audience liked it. So there you have it. But I don't know that it's going to be anywhere else. I don't know if they're going to move. Certainly, the set is Broadway ready, and that's very good. But I think it would be a tough sell on Broadway. And the actual title is Clue on Stage, so they make it clear that they are talking about the film. So, so who done it? Well, I'd say Ana Luis has done it, and so did the cast. But Jonathan Lynn did it a long time ago, and I'm not sure that Hunter Foster and Eric Price really did very much to make it more stage-worthy than film-worthy.
Peter, do you think possibly instead of being a Broadway production, this could be some sort of Thursday, Friday, Saturday evening type
environmental, of thing? Environmental, yeah. Walk through the rooms kind of thing?
Oh, that would have been interesting. Sure. It might be a good midnight show, you know. So I see your point there. Ken Davenport's always saying, you know, the 8-performance week is so obsolete. I mean, especially the Wednesday matinee, because there was a time when women didn't work and came into the city and saw shows. That was their treat. But, you know, most women work today and they don't have time to go to a Wednesday matinee. So yeah, I think, you know, Ken has been very, very, very successful and deservedly so by scheduling all sorts of atypical performances for his shows. And so who knows? Maybe he'll be the one to bring Clued in and do it, as you say, Thursday, Friday, Saturdays, maybe at midnight or some other odd time. Might be a good idea.
All right. So next up, we are going to jump from New Hope, Pennsylvania, up to the Boston area, where Michael got to see the Bridges of Madison County at Speakeasy Stage. So, Michael, tell us about the Bridges of Madison County.
Well, speaking of Hunter Foster, you know, he was in the Broadway production, so that's a little helps us in our segue here. This is the third production of the show that I've seen, but in a sense, it's only the second production because I saw it on Broadway, and then I saw it down at the Kennedy Center at the Eisenhower Theater, which is part of the tour, which basically was the same production in terms of the sets and direction and everything. This is the first different and much smaller, much more intimate production by the Speakeasy Stage Company at the Calderwood Pavilion at the Boston Center for the Arts, the equivalent of a off-Broadway scale production, small off-Broadway scale production. And I'm thrilled to report that the show worked as well, if not even better, on that more intimate scale. Interestingly enough, each of the performances of this show that I have seen, I saw it twice on Broadway, then once at the Kennedy Center, and now once in Boston. Each time I've seen it, the flaws in it have mattered much less to me. And now it's to the point where I think basically the flaws are not even worth mentioning. There are a few things, but overall, Marcia Norman, the book writer, and certainly Jason Robert Brown, who wrote the music and lyrics, did a exemplary, beautiful job of musicalizing a film that was really before it was a film, it was a book. And from the beginning, in all those incarnations, some people have loved it. Some people have just derided it as trashy kind of women's romance, third-rate literature. I don't agree with that. Assessment, that latter assessment. Although, again, I've never read the book. I'm only going from the movie and the musical. Whatever it started out as, I think this has turned out to be a really, really beautiful property. This production, directed by M. Bevan O'Gara, music direction by Matthew Stern, choreographed by Misha Shields, was completely satisfying, although very small in many ways. The cast was smaller than on Broadway and on tour. The orchestra was much smaller and yet sounded just great. And aside from everything, they had two really wonderful leads here. We have as Francesca Jennifer Ellis and as Robert Christian Smith. That's Christian Smith. Jennifer Ellis was superb as Francesca, perhaps a little too young for the role, but that's okay. Her singing was gorgeous. She looked beautiful. She was incredibly Italian, which helped a lot. And I was sitting there watching her and I'm like, where have I seen this woman before? I thought I had seen her somewhere. And then I looked at her bio and of all things, her only New York credit seems to be Sheer Madness. I saw her in that, which is, of course, not a musical. So it was great to see her have an opera-level soprano that she used beautifully in this show, and her acting was every bit as good as her singing. Christian Smith also just an incredibly beautiful Barry tenor with the emphasis on the Barry. I would say his lower register was just beautiful. Acting wise, I thought he was a little stiff maybe, but I was thinking that that's actually better than the opposite, especially in this show, because if either of the leads, if they do too much emoting, it can kind of tip over into bathos and melodrama, which is the last thing that we want. So I don't really even think that whatever stiffness he had was a liability, and he fit the part perfectly and he looked great. And so I don't mean that there was anything really significant about that issue. The supporting cast, everyone was fantastic. The kids were great. I want to signal out Kerry A. Dowling, who played Marge, and Will McGarahan, who played her husband Charlie. Just perfectly etched little character portraits. I'm so glad I went. I actually, believe it or not, did a day trip to Boston to see this show. I went in the morning. I saw the matinee and I came back that night. I don't like to do that, but I just on this occasion I needed to, and I don't regret it. I do not regret it. I really loved it, and I'm so glad that I saw it, and I might try to get back there too if time and budget, et cetera, permit.
Well, that is playing through June 3rd at the Speakeasy Stage, and I'll have a link to that in the show notes. I'd like to get up there. Bridges is one of my favorite shows, and with your recommendation there, I seem like I should get up there to check it out.
Well, again, really happy to see that it works into such a small production, because this is the first time I've seen that, and you know, you never know until you see it. So,
making way for a good transition here, let's chat briefly about the New York Pops 34th birthday gala, which honored, who was it, that Kelly somebody?
Yeah, someone that James has heard of maybe occasionally. Kelly O'Hara and Bartlett Sher, who of course have had a great collaboration on several shows, but also had magnificent careers separately. And the people gathered, the performers gathered to honor them, included Matthew Broderick, Jason Robert Brown, who played while Stephen Reinecke conducted the Pops, in a beautiful suite from the Bridges of Madison County that opened the performance. This was the debut of that suite, I believe, and it was just beautiful. Other performers, excuse me, Danny Burstein, Brian Darcy James, Adam Cantor, Judy Kuhn, opera singer Isabel Leonard, Rebecca Luker, Maren Mazey, who, you know, this was the first time I have seen Maren on stage since her illness, and she was just beautiful and magnificent, and it was hard for me not to weep to see her there. She really sounded and looked great. Ruthie Ann Miles, Tony winner for The King and I, Laura Osnes, Stephen Pasquale, Chris Sullivan, Paolo Schott, and the kids on stage, and several other little guest artists. It was really a wonderful, wonderful night, and rather a short concert, only about an hour and a half, because it was their gala, and so they had to make way for the party afterwards. But everything in it was was just delightful. Every music from, in addition to, well, let's see, in addition to Bridges, Nice Work If You Can Get It, Sweet Smell of Success, Fiddler on the Roof, South Pacific, King and I, and Light in the Piazza. The Kelly herself sang at the end of the show. Even though she was being honored, she sang because she said, "I can't imagine not singing to honor Bart Sher." And she actually did Fable from The Light in the Piazza, which of course was not her number. It was the finale sung by Victoria Clark. But that's what she did, and it was really great to hear her do that. And another wonderful, wonderful evening in the theater, in the concert world.
All right. Well, that's very exciting. And interesting thing to note, we talked with Bart Sher on This Week on Broadway, a few months back. And I asked him about his involvement in Bridges. And it was actually Kelly who brought Bartlett into Bridges, which I thought, I hadn't known before, and I thought that was really interesting that Kelly said to Jason, "You really should, you know, talk to Bart about this," and that's how that all happened. Jumping around back from Boston down to the George Street Playhouse in New Brunswick, New Jersey, Peter got a chance to see the Curvy Widow. So, Peter, tell us about Curvy Widow.
Well, this is Bobby Goldman's musical, and Bobby Goldman has written a very autobiographical show about her and her husband, James Goldman. Now, many of us recognize that name, not just because he wrote The Lion in Winter, but also because he wrote the book To Follies. So he's one of our heroes, and he's in the show for a little bit. Not a lot, because the show is called Curvy Widow. This is the term she uses when she's placing an ad on Match.com. And so it's mostly about what happens after he dies and what it's like to be a woman starting over. Now, one has seen this type of story many, many times before, and one assumes what's going to happen is that she's going to go on 109 bad dates before she finally finds capital T, capital L, true love. No, it doesn't happen that way, and it may not have happened that way because, indeed, that was not Bobby Goldman's experience, or she's wise enough to know that you don't do that because everybody's expecting that. So it's not about that at all. It's about a woman finding herself in a very different way and being successful on her own terms. What is disappointing in the show is that it's a musical, and I'm afraid the music makes no impression whatsoever in any way, shape, or form. Drew Brody is the guy who wrote it, and it's not terrible or anything, but it just, as I say, makes no impression. He does the lyrics too, and they're rather routine. I mean, Bobby sings about the years that she had with James, so you know the word tears is going to be used in the next line, and it certainly is. So that's, of course, always a disappointment in any musical. But what's really impressive is to watch Bobby Goldman admit that she's essentially the lioness in Winter when you think of it. And in her Playbill bio, it's just 16 words. That's it. And here it is. Since my slutdom is on stage, I'm really not sure I have anything else to add. So we always hear that women tend to do it on the third date. Well, Bobby does it on the first date, and she's very happy to do that. And that's, in a way, startling and, on the other hand, refreshing. Well, it's a very good role, though, for a terrific actress, and they have one at the George Street Playhouse, and that is Nancy Opel, who reminds me a great deal of Dorothy Loudon in this. I really almost felt that I was watching Dorothy Loudon in this part. That's in case people have forgotten the name, and I hope they haven't. That's Annie's original Miss Hannigan. And it sounds like a backhanded compliment, but I mean that she seems to be as commensurate in spirit and in talent as Dorothy Loudon. So she's really, really quite, quite good. And she barely leaves the stage. She has unapologetic gray hair as she goes through her machinations. And it's really very impressive. There are six other actors in the show that are basically limited to cameos. They rush on the stage and they're there for like less than a minute, rush off and change to be the next character. So all things considered, it really is Nancy Opel's show, and she makes the most of it. Now, I will say that it occurred to me, I don't think it'll occur to very many people, but starting over is easier when you're flush, isn't it? It's not for me to say that Miss Goldman is wealthy from those Lion in Winter and Follies royalties, and she does say she has her own income from a business that's not associated with women, but yeah, you do come away at least respecting the show for not going in the trite direction you expected it to. So while it's not a memorable musical, and it can't be with that score, it's still, the term that James used last week that he claims that I use from time to time, sit-through-able, and it certainly is.
All right. So Did I coin you with that? I thought that I'd heard you say that before, but maybe.
Right. That's it. You know, you credited me. It's a term I've used for decades, but you used it recently and credited me. So no hard feelings or anything. But anyway,
okay.
it's a valid term, I think. You know,
I think it's a term that comes in handy often. Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure that you are the first person I've ever heard to say that. Unlike maybe Prime the Pump.
Good for you. Yes, indeed.
All right. Let's not claim things that...
Right.
All right. Let's have a little lightning round here, because Michael and I have seen four shows that people have... I'm sure people have seen it, but Peter has seen it. A Doll's House Part 2, 6 Degrees of Separation, The Little Foxes in Oslo. Michael and I saw both all four of those, and Peter has reviewed them previously. So, Michael, you want to start with the one that you most want to talk about? I think 6 Degrees, is that?
Well, you know what? I was thinking I wanted to make the point. I was thinking of Peter a lot recently because I know that Peter loves plays in which different characters represent their points of view, and they do it so compellingly that you agree with each character while he or she is doing it. And then the other character presents his or her point of view, and then you say, oh, yeah, you know, that's right. I never thought of it that way. And it struck me that this I completely agree that that makes for great drama. And two of these plays, at least two of these plays, fall into that category, A Doll's House Part 2 and Oslo. A Doll's House Part 2, which I have to say was not at all what I originally feared it would be when I heard the title. I don't know why. I just thought it was going to be this heavy, pretentious, treatise on A Doll's House by Ibsen. It's showing us what happens afterwards. There certainly are. It does get to be very, very heavy and very dramatic. But also, it's so clever. And the first part of it is basically a comedy. Very, very, very well written by Lucas, however his last name is pronounced, H-N-A-T-H, Nath, Nath.
No idea.
And so the audience, I think that the comedy really, really draws the audience into the show. It's been discussed on the podcast previously, so I won't get into the details. But Nora returns home after 15 years after slamming the door on her husband, Torvald, and walking out on her husband and her children. And she comes back for a specific reason. And there again, now, if anyone who's ever seen A Doll's House, I think that everyone would say that Nora's actions are perfectly understandable in walking out and that she did exactly what she needed to do and she was right and Torvald was wrong. Well, believe it or not, in A Doll's House Part 2, Lucas Nath gives Torvald, played by Chris Cooper, a couple of speeches in which he gives his perception of what happened. And it is, you actually sit there and say, you know, he's right. So I think that's an amazing achievement for a playwright to put words in the mouth of Torvald Helmer that make you think that he's really wasn't a complete villain and that maybe Nora did the wrong thing and just completely abandoning her marriage and her children. So brilliantly acted by Laurie Metcalf and Chris Cooper and Jane Houdyshell as the maid and Condola Rashad as the daughter of Torvald and Helmer, Torvald and Nora. So that's what I have to say about A Doll's House that struck me most of all. And then in Oslo, which is a dramatization of these peace talks between the Israelis and the Palestinians that were orchestrated by two Norwegian diplomats, it's very, very much based in truth. The character names are the names of the actual people. And here again, directed by Bart Lecher, written by J.T. Rogers. But in this case, you have the Israelis and the Palestinians on stage, brilliantly acted by several actors, including Michael Aronoff and Anthony Azizi and Adam Danheiser, etc. And again, they present their perspectives on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and their own personal views and the way each of them looks at it in such a compelling way that while each one of them is speaking, you think, well, absolutely, of course, they're right and the other side is wrong. So just I think that's really kind of amazing and wonderful for a playwright to be able to do that. And I can't praise either of these playwrights too highly. I think they're really just really brilliant.
So I was wondering if I could run something by you guys. So A Doll's House Part 2, I saw it last week, and I really enjoyed it. And it just does not seem to be selling very well. And I wondered if there was – if you thought that this was a gimmick or this would help sales, if maybe they had done although it's a different writer, Ibsen's A Doll's House – Four Nights a Week and A Doll's House Part 2 on the other four nights, or the other, not four nights, but four performances, you know, to kind of, you know.
Yeah, sure.
Bring people up to speed. Not that you need to see Part 1
in order to see
Part 2. You don't need to do that, but possibly this could have generated more buzz. I mean, I looked at IBDB and there's 13 productions of A Doll's House that have played Broadway since 1889 till 1997. So last time it was seen on Broadway was 1997. I wondered if that would have helped a little, knowing that it seems that this show has legs, the original one, A Doll's House, and could have given a boost to the second one. I wonder if that would have been feasible or not.
Well, I'll bet my life, not that I have that many years to go, but I'll bet my life that indeed some rep theater in this country will do that exactly.
Yes.
That they will put the two plays in rep. And after all, you don't have to pay royalties for Doll's House anymore. Probably not. I mean, I guess there are certain translations where you'd have to. But still, I maintain it's a very good idea, James, and I like it immeasurably. And I'm looking for a regional theater to do it. And it'll certainly be a good story, and I'll make every effort to be there when some rep theater tries it.
There's a little bit of an issue in that there's supposed to be 15 years passing, so there would need to be some effort in making the actors look older in the second tap. Sure. And obviously the children would not from the first one would not be used in the second one. But yes, I think that's a really great idea, James.
All right. And also, I want to echo what Peter had said about Six Degrees, that I thought the production was really, really good, and it was a really great time to see Six Degrees back on Broadway. I felt it was a little bit, it felt dated to me, and I'm not sure you know why was, because they didn't have any did they have specific references to pop culture or things like that? I don't really
Cats.
Right.
Cats the movie,
back.
You know.
But
it is true.
There we are. It's back. You never know from the Tonys, but Cats is back.
Yeah. And that also that Corey Hawkins was fine, but I felt that he was too old, just as was mentioned before. It would have been great to get somebody that felt younger in that he just didn't pass as Paul for me. But I really enjoyed the production. It was great to see Allison Janney on stage. Janney, did I get that wrong somewhere? Is it Janney? Yeah. This is a really, really good production, and the children of the couples, I had forgotten how bratty they were and how much I wanted to smack all of them, but that was something I do recall. And they were
James.
It was
James, yes. You're looking at your own future.
Oh, no kidding! And then We had talked about Oslo previously, and that Oslo, I had seen it off-Broadway downstairs at Lincoln Center, and it moved upstairs, and that I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it upstairs a little bit less than I enjoyed it downstairs. It seemed like everybody, not, I shouldn't say everybody, it seems like a lot of lines were yelled,
you know,
upstairs, James.
I did notice that also. I absolutely noticed that, and I meant to mention it. So we had the same experience. Were we at the same performance?
I don't
think we were, but regardless,
did I see you there?
Yeah, it's the set is quite open, and so I think that they were very conscious of the fact that they needed to project more, and it did seem sometimes that it came across as yelling.
Oh, you know what, Michael? I don't think I was at the same performance of Oslo as you, because I was a few minutes late.
Oh.
I stood in the back, and I was sitting next to Bart Scher. came into the theater late. It was a tremendous subway issue that I gave myself. It took me an hour to get from like Penn Station to Lincoln Center, and we should have just walked it. It was just ridiculous. So there was that. So that was Doll's House, 6 Degrees, Oslo, Little Foxes. I didn't talk about Little Foxes, but I saw Cynthia Nixon as Birdie, and I really enjoyed it. Again, it was these four plays together in any seat, you know, spread out over multiple seasons is amazing. To have these all in the same season and competing against each other, what a season we've had.
And what
I
mean, to, you know, Lillian Hellman's Little Foxes, it's amazing how it's held up. I think it's just brilliant. And I'm so glad I saw the same combination that James did. I saw Laura Linney as Regina and Cynthia Nixon as Birdie. I would love to see the other combination, but I think it's a great idea that they're doing switching, because I think it calls more attention to the production, which deserves all the attention, not only for that, but for everything else. Richard Thomas is excellent as Horace, and everyone else, Michael McKean and everyone else in the cast. And it's a beautiful production physically, scenic design by Scott Pass, costumes, Jane Greenwood, lighting, Justin Townsend, and brilliantly directed by Daniel Sullivan. One of the best Manhattan Theater Club revivals, I think, recently. I have a couple of things I'd like to say about 6 Degrees, if we have a moment.
Yeah.
I didn't have that problem with Corey Hawkins looking too young. I know several people too old. Yeah. I know several people have said that. I don't know. He looked fine to me. I actually think Courtney Vance.
That means you're getting older, Michael.
Certainly could have something to do with it. And I very much liked his performance, the way that he was like making a real effort to ingratiate himself. I also thought Allison Janney and John Benjamin Hickey were excellent as Wiesa and Flan Kittredge. As far as the kids, James, I think the material written for them is some of the best parts of the play, especially when the one kid goes off on the character.
Pink shirt.
Yes, but also the kid who goes off on the character played by Ned Eisenberg. What is his name? Dr. Fine, the doctor character.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You let him into the house.
Yeah, are you telling me you're such an idiot that you and he just lays into him, you know? But that said, I think that that the direction of the kids in this production was maybe it could have been a little stronger, because I think they went a little too far in some cases. And I think maybe that's why it never struck you before that they were so incredibly bratty. This play, I've always had mixed feelings about it. I think there's a lot of great stuff in it, and I love the theme of it. And I think it was really great that John Guare chose to dramatize this again, real life situation. But I don't know. I've always thought from day one that this play has a real really off-putting, homophobic air about it. The fact that this character it brings a hustler, a male hustler, into the home of Wiesa and Flan on the night that he, you know, is supposedly attacked, and that's why he comes to them and they befriend him, and he pretends to know their children from college. You know, I mean, gosh, why would he bring a hustler into their home, knowing very well that they might find this guy? And when he's doing everything possible to pretend that he's Sidney Poitier's son and ingratiate himself to them and make him think he's an upstanding individual. This is addressed later on in the play, but I don't buy what the reason that he says that he brought the hustler in. And I think it's just there for shock value. And of course, it has to be a guy that he's sleeping with, you know, because it has to be homophobic. There's equation of homosexuals with drug addicts on two or three occasions in two or three different lines. And then towards the end of the play, Paul cons this couple from Utah, and the guy of the couple winds up killing himself because he says that Paul eventually, the evening ended with him being fucked, pardon the expression, by Paul. And so there again, homosexual panic. It has to be, you know, having him being fucked by the guy. And many people disagree with me, but I think it's a very, very homophobic play. And I wish that it had been, that those elements of it had been rewritten from the beginning. So that's my thought on Six Degrees.
Has anybody ever asked Sidney Poitier what he thinks of this play? I've never read anything about that.
I don't know, but I mean, he sort of is very peripheral. He just happens to be the person that this guy says he was the son of. It's not.
No, sure. But if you were interviewing Sidney Poitier, wouldn't you bring it up?
Yeah,
I would.
Yeah.
So I wonder, there must be somewhere that's worth Googling as well to see if indeed Sidney Poitier has any opinions pro or con.
And again, I referred to our podcast of 2 weeks ago, if anyone cares to listen, where I narrate how I saw this con man in action one day.
Yeah.
I still can't quite believe that I saw that. But so I feel a real connection to Six Degrees of Separation in that way.
All right, Peter, you made your way back to New York City, down to Bond Street, where you saw the retro production of And Miss Reardon Drinks a Little. So tell us about that.
Well, one of the biggest laughs I ever heard in a theater was for the original production of this play, in which a juicer went off as a punctuation of a blender, I should say. Yeah, you know, you turn that type of thing. After Julie Harris made the observation that if you eat a certain percentage of vegetables in a certain way, your feces will not smell. And at that point, the blender went off and the place went crazy. The blender goes off here too, but it's a very low-level blender. And as a result, it doesn't get the laugh. And it's a metaphor for the entire production. This is not a good production of And Miss Reardon Drinks a Little, a 1971 play by Paul Zindel. Now, to be fair, this is one of those situations where Paul Zindel, who had been around for years and trying to get his plays on and having a very difficult time, and then finally somebody does one, The Effect of Gamma Rays on Man in the Moon Marigolds, and suddenly he's this hot playwright, and people said, what else do you got? And he brings out a play from before, and that's in Miss Reardon Drinks a Little, and they produce it, and it doesn't work out because it's not all that good. And it isn't. It's about three teachers, two of whom have gone on to more high positions in school, and the difficulties they have with each other. And there are some funny lines, certainly, and some vivid characterizations, to be sure. But it just doesn't go particularly far enough in any direction to make you very interested. What is interesting is that one of the husbands comes in and starts telling people off, and it is something to see the man take charge. And I think that's what's supposed to be the power of the play, that these women who have lived pretty self-actualized lives suddenly are cowed by this man. So not that interesting, and not a good production at all by Retro, which usually does terrific productions. Everybody misses from time to time. This is their time to miss because the direction makes everybody so screechy and over the top and really underlines every possible gag line with three lines underneath it, a yellow highlighter and an arrow that's red. So I'm afraid this is a miss for Retro, and we can't hold it against them because everybody does miss, and these plays that they bring back from who knows where and who knows when are certainly worth time and attention for the most part, but this was one time and it wasn't.
All right. Next up, we have three quick things from Michael. Michael, you got to see the Masterwork Voices Babes in Toyland back April 27th at Carnegie Hall. Telly Leung's Hello Young Lovers at the Green Room, and the upcoming Broadway Roast, which we'll talk about. So why don't you tell us about Babes in Toyland?
Yeah, it's Master Voices, formerly the Collegiate Chorale, presented one-nighter, so there was no way that we would have been able to, review it while it was still running. But very, very rare presentation of virtually the entire score, I guess, of Babes in Toyland, music by Victor Herbert, book and lyrics by Glenn McDonough. And with a really excellent cast, Blair Brown was the narrator. Then we had Jeffrey Schechter, Chris Sullivan, Jonathan Freeman, Christopher Fitzgerald, Lauren Worsham, Jay Armstrong Johnson, Anna Landy, et cetera, et cetera. Kelly O'Hara, Bill Irwin, and I'm not even naming everyone. It was a very large cast. The Orchestra of St. Luke's, conducted by Ted Sperling, who also directed. And they gave us a concert presentation with some dialogue scenes, but a lot of the dialogue, I would say, blessedly cut. This is a very, very old show and extremely quaint in many ways, certainly as far as the book is concerned. Any interest in it now would be because of the music, the songs, the music and lyrics. So we got all or most of that, as I said, a narration was written that Blair Brown read it. I didn't actually love the narration. I thought some of it was a little snarky and a little condescending, but for whatever it's worth, again, the main reason to see this was for the score. And for me, and for anyone I think who grew up in New York, and is of now of a certain age, I think this was a fascinating thing because we all know very, very well the film version, the 1937, I believe, film version of Babes in Toyland, originally released as Babes in Toyland and later retitled March of the Wooden Soldiers with Laurel and Hardy leading the cast. And that movie, we know that very well because it was shown every year like clockwork at holiday time. I can't remember for sure now which holiday, but maybe two. I think definitely around Christmas. That movie has only three or four songs from the score. But as it turns out, and as I discovered at this wonderful concert that the Master Voices presented, a great deal of the score of the original Babes in Toyland is used as underscore in the film, and I think even with the original orchestrations. So to hear all of that played live was something I never thought would ever happen in my lifetime, and it was absolutely thrilling. And I'm very grateful to Master Voices for picking this show. And it's yet another case of something where if you didn't see and hear this, that may have been your last opportunity. I hope not, but who knows? Telly Leung, with whom we spoke on the podcast several weeks ago, did a wonderful show at the new cabaret space called The Green Room at the Yotel. And we can never have enough cabaret spaces, especially if they're as nice as this one. So that's the good news. And he did a great show called Hello Young Lovers that was largely autobiographical about his own life and his own relationship with his current partner, but about love in general. And certainly people have use that as subject matter before, but he did a great job of it. The show is very delightful and funny and not too heavy, and had a great song stack, including Hello Young Lovers, Married from Cabaret, a little mini medley of Married and We Can Make It, Leaving on a Jet Plane, I Will Survive, I'm Gonna Laugh You Right Out of My Life, I Can See Clearly Now, and ending with Being Alive from Company, which I thought was really appropriate. Music arrangements by Telly himself, Gary Adler, Marianne McSweeney, and Rick Hip Flores. So I hope to see Telly again in future cabaret shows, and I definitely plan to be back at the Green Room. And I think they're going to have a lot of excellent people there. So make a note to check them out and online and see what they have coming up. Coming up, still in our future on Monday, May 22nd, this sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. There's going to be a benefit roast of Michael Musto. Broadway roasts Michael Musto, titled Fork on the Left, Knife in the Back, on Monday, May 22nd at the Actors Temple to benefit the Callan Lord Community Health Center. Participants announced include Rosie O'Donnell, Bruce Valanche, Michael Urie, Orfei, Michael Riedel, Luann de Lesseps, Randy Rainbow, Lucy the Slut. These are only some of the people announced. So go to www.broadwayroast.com for more information, because I think that's something you'll really want to see. And finally, I went to a major press conference for an incredible, well, I can't call it an event, an omnibus event, I guess, of Leonard Bernstein at 100. It's going to be a series of concerts, performances, other events over several years honoring the life and career of the legendary conductor and composer Leonard Bernstein. More than 1,000 events on 6 continents, kicking off in September of 2017 at the Kennedy Center. This press conference was among the speakers were Alec Baldwin, who is the voice of the New York Philharmonic, so that's why he was there. Whoopi Goldberg spoke. The 3 Bernstein children, Jamie, Alexander, and Nina, spoke. Also, Yannick Nézet-Séguin, who is principal conductor of the Philadelphia Orchestra and music director designate of the Metropolitan Opera. And they spoke about only a handful of these hundreds of events that are going to be happening, including several documentary films, a worldwide tour of, quote, the acclaimed BB Promotions West Side Story, productions of Wonderful Town in Germany and Austria, performances of Mass, Bernstein's Mass, in London, Paris, Los Angeles, Glasgow, and Austin, and Bernstein's opera A Quiet Place in Vienna and Budapest, among other cities. Again, this is a tiny, tiny fraction of what's going to happen. So check out the website, which James will put in the show notes. And it's just incredible what's going to be occurring with this.
Wow, this is a great thing. I'm looking at Leonard Bernstein at 100 on the LeonardBernstein.com website. Just so many great things for us to go see. So something special has happened this week where we have had multiple announcements of upcoming live productions on television. So whenever that happens, we bring in our superstar reporter from the South.
No pun intended.
Matt Tamanini, thank you for coming on this week on Broadway. What's going on?
Well, we've had quite the busy week in terms of, as you said, theatrical content being announced for live productions on broadcast networks this week. This whole week, if you've noticed on Twitter, there's been a lot of the news about TV show cancellations and pickups. This is the normal time for that to happen ahead of next week's upfront presentations for all the advertisers and stuff. So we got all these announcements about things coming to both NBC and Fox. And I got to be honest, normally when these things are announced, I'm kind of lukewarm on what's being announced, but I think I'm really excited about all three of these. First, on Wednesday, NBC announced that they would be doing a live broadcast of Jesus Christ Superstar. It'll be produced by Neil Marin and Craig Zidane, as all of the NBC live musicals have been, but they're also involving Andrew Lloyd Webber, Tim Rice, and Mark Platt. Mark Platt is a name that will become redundant here as we continue to talk about this. What's interesting about this is not only are they doing this fairly still a little bit satirical, if not blasphemous, musical on national television, they're actually doing it on Easter Sunday next year, April 1st of 2018. And I noted on Today on Broadway, I think it's kind of funny that not only is it Easter, but it's also April Fool's Day. So it seems very appropriate for Jesus Christ Superstar to be done on that day. Bob Greenblatt, the chairman of NBC, who also has dabbled in producing for Broadway as well, has said that casting has already begun and they want to fill out this classic show with as many recording artists as possible to give proper voice to what is the original rock opera score. So there's a lot of names being bandied about, nothing confirmed, but this one should be pretty exciting. And then on Friday, we got a double dose of announcements from Fox, again, both produced by Mark Platt. Interesting enough, he had obviously has done a bunch on Broadway and in Hollywood, but he did produce Grease Live, which is probably one of, if not the most successful of these live broadcasts. First, we got news that this coming December, to kind of compete with NBC's Bye Bye Birdie Live, we're going to get a live broadcast of the musical of the classic Christmas film, A Christmas Story. This was seen on Broadway. It has a score by Benj Pasek and Justin Paul, who will be writing several new songs for the live broadcast. And then Jonathan Tolens and Robert Carey, who are both playwrights and librettists in their own right, but did adapt the screenplay for Grease Live. They will be doing the book for A Christmas Story. That, again, will come up this December 2017. No official date has been announced for that. And then later in the day on Friday, like literally the normal time when only unimportant things or things that people don't want you to hear about gets dumped. Late in the day on Friday, we heard that with no specific timetable attached, Fox will be producing a live broadcast of Rent. Mark Platt will again be producing along with the estate of Jonathan Larson. This one brings up so many questions and so many concerns. But I'm excited to see what they do with all three of these. These are three very different properties, but all, well, at least two of them are very different. And I'll say it this way. All three of them are very different in a number of ways from what has been done on these live broadcasts over the last 4 or 5 years.
So Christmas Story, let's dissect this a little bit. Christmas Story from Pasek and Paul. And Peter, you have been a fan of Christmas Story, the musical, the live version of the musical for a while. And it's
I actually saw their tech rehearsal in Hershey, Pennsylvania when they were just starting out. So and the fact that they're writing additional songs for it sounds great to me because I love when they write in that style.
Mm. And who's producing Christmas Story?
Well, that is one Mark Platt who was doing that one.
Mark Platt, any relation to anybody else on Broadway?
Well, his son is Ben Platt, who stars in the Pasek and Paul musical Dear Evan Hansen.
Oh,
but also remember, that could be something that might be interesting for Rent purposes. But also remember, Mark Platt did produce La La Land, which Pasek and Paul won an Oscar for. So this is not just like, hey, we met backstage at Dear Evan Hansen. This is a long relationship that with Pasek and Paul.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, I think that A Christmas Story is a great, great choice for treatment. And the other two, it's not that I'm not excited about them, but others have pointed out that there are at least, there are two other film or video versions of each of those other properties. Because for Rent, there's the film and that really terrific live performance that they did with the final cast on Broadway. And then for Superstar, I'm not even sure exactly where each of them is from, but there are two videos of live performances. I think one is a live concert and the other one is a sort of a TV production.
Yeah, one, well, I mean, there's actually three if you throw in the original movie.
The movie, I'm sorry.
But then there's the one of with Tim Minchin as Judas that was like the big arena spectacular in the UK a few years ago. And then there was one that's even a little older than that. And I'm like you, Michael, I don't know exactly where it comes from, but it's very stylized. I mean, there's a bunch of, you know, TV, you know, Caiaphas and Annas are singing with a bunch of TV monitors around him. It's very you know, modern like the original one was, but even more so because it was done more recently. So you're right. There are definitely a lot of these around. Although in the case of Rent, I don't know that anyone is going to be too disappointed to try to wash the taste out of the Christopher Columbus directed film out of their mouth.
Yeah. But Matt, have you seen that Broadway one?
I have it. Yeah. It's great.
I think that's terrific. Yeah.
Yeah. And I believe Renee Lee Scoldsberry is Mimi, and is Will Chase Roger?
Chase.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's a great cast.
What's really interesting about Jesus Christ Superstar is that when it opened on Broadway, pickets were surrounding the theater because they were considering this, as James mentioned, blasphemous. So how interesting to see in 46 years it's gone from something that has been an atrocity to so many people to something that now is going to be very mainstream. As you say, Easter Sunday, it's almost considered now a tribute to Jesus. So as opposed to taking down his name and sullying about. So very, very interesting how times change.
Well, you know, are all three of you products of Catholic school?
I think you are.
And Matt had mentioned on Today on Broadway that there were Jesus Christ Superstar album burnings in the day.
Yes,
so
yes.
Certainly that supports what Peter is saying there. It'd be very interesting to see if we're going to have some sort of protest these days about it, or if it will just move on, or if any of these, you know, Rent can be very political. I wonder if Superstar might be political in the way in which they direct it. So,
for what it's worth, I've always thought that that the text itself of the show does not necessarily deny the divinity of Jesus. Just because Judas does it doesn't mean that it's true. Now, people also focus on the fact that we don't see a resurrection, but that could certainly be changed in the staging. And actually, I always thought that the staging of the original production kind of hinted at a resurrection. So I just think that you know, is a point that I wanted to make as to why how it can be justified to present that on Easter Sunday.
Well, and if you think about it, Godspell doesn't mention a resurrection either, but no one's ever really protested Godspell as far as I know. One thing about, you know, kind of...
Because Jesus Christ Superstar died for its sins. That's why. Because it came first.
That's true. That's good. Although portraying Jesus as a clown, I think some people have had issues with that. But Michael, you mentioned they might do something different for this. One thing to keep in mind, though, is that Tim Rice and Andrew Lloyd Webber will be part of the production team for this. So I would imagine that any potential changes or modifications that they make for a television broadcast would have to be approved from on high, no pun intended, over at the Really Useful group. So it would be interesting to see how they do that. But I think, as Peter mentioned, over the 46 years, I think people have started to understand that this is a story told from Judas's perspective more so than Jesus's. It's not a traditional passion play like we saw that terrible thing that Tyler Perry did on Fox last year. You know, that was a more traditional passion play. Jesus Christ Superstar is a much more, as you said, politicized look at the surroundings to what happened in Jesus's final week on Earth.
Well, yeah, and I just wanted to make clear, I'm not talking about any kind of rewriting. I just think that in the staging of the ending, that one could cover oneself and leave it open to interpretation as to the resurrection.
Sort of like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory not bringing back the kids.
Yeah, right.
You could say the curtain call is their resurrection.
I see. All right, Matt. Well, thank you for jumping in here and giving us the update on what to expect here. It looks like five good television productions heading our way, and as they happen, well, I'm sure we'll have three.
I'll say there's probably four good ones heading our way. The fifth one that we didn't mention is Dirty Dancing on ABC, which is coming up on May 24th. I've seen the screener. If you enjoy the original Dirty Dancing, watch that instead of this.
Okay. All right. So we will get you back on as these things happen and give us your reviews on them. Once again, we'd like to thank the folks at heartbeatopera.org for sponsoring today's episode of This Week on Broadway. So go check them out at heartbeatopera.org. We'll have links to that in the show notes. All right. So before we go for the day, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone or your BlackBerry. iHeartRadio also plays us. You can get us at the Google Play Store. You can listen to us on TuneIn or in Stitcher. Many different places, and Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, for Matt, and for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today, including Leonard Bernstein's thing, Michael's review of The Golden Apple, and some other things there. So, Peter, do you have an answer to last week's trivia?
Well, last week I said because we recently had celebrated Sheldon Harnick's 93rd birthday, I wanted to do a question that involved two of his shows. First, The Apple Tree, which has a song called In Gaul, G-A-U-L, meaning the country most remembered from Julius Caesar's commentary on the Gallic Wars. However, Harnick had used the expression in Gaul earlier in his career, but in a very different context and spelling. So what song and what show? Well, it's Fiorello. Because in the song, the name's LaGuardia, Fiorello sings, there's a double M in Tammany and a double L in Gaul, G-A-L-L. So Fred Abramowitz was the first to get it, followed by Albert Rhine, Charles Randall, and Christopher Daniels. Michael, you have one, huh?
Yes, I think this is a fun question. I'm not sure how easy it is, but I'm sure our listeners will let us know. Okay, ready? What two shows currently running on Broadway include more than one scene that takes place in the same building? Now, to clarify what I'm asking, there is one musical that has more than one scene in a certain building, and there's another Broadway musical currently running that has more than one scene in that same building. So name the two shows and the building.
All right. So if you have that answer, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com. We'll let you know if you're on the right track. So on behalf of Peter Felicia, Michael Portantier, and Matt Tamanini, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.